MacCast, Friday, May 8th, 2015. This episode of the MacCast is brought to you by lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I have a great episode lined up for you. We have so much stuff to talk about. A lot of it's going to be Apple Watch, because that is Apple's thing of the moment. We've talked about this in the past. This is kind of the cycle that happens. Anytime Apple comes out with a new product, a lot of the news, a lot of the information centers around that new product. And boy, do we got some good information, though. Teardowns of the Apple Watch going on, so we're starting to know a little bit more about what has gone in to make up the Apple Watch. Possible explanation for why you may not have your Apple Watch yet. So slow shipments, what's going on there? A few more Apple Watch odds and ends. We got some information about Apple Pay. What's happening with the iPad? Are we going to get new iPads? What is Apple going to do about sales of the iPad? And then rumors surrounding Apple's upcoming WWDC announcements, most specifically what's happening with their media and media service initiatives. So we're going to talk about those, and we've got some great feedback from you, some comments and questions. Also going to talk a little bit about how to get more out of your Apple Watch, understanding how movement works, some tips and tricks. And then get into an issue that I have suffered from, and you may have as well, with networking. Our friend Craig Hockenberry has been going off on his blog, and he's pretty upset about what's going on, and might have at least an explanation, if not some possible workarounds and fixes for some of the network issues some of us have been facing under OS X Yosemite. And then, of course, my thing of the moment and all that good stuff. But before we get into all of it, let me take a quick moment of your time and say a thank you to one of my sponsors. Love sponsors here on the MacCast. We've got some great ones, and lynda.com is no exception. Hey, look, lynda.com is for us. It's for problem solvers. It's for people who are curious, who want to know more about technology, for those of us who want to get in, use our machines, and make things happen. So whether you want to learn Photoshop or master Excel, or maybe you just want to get better at negotiation tactics, so maybe you can get a raise at your job, maybe you need to build a website, lynda.com can help you with all of that stuff. It can feed your curious mind. And lynda.com, in case you don't know, is online training courses. They have great video courses along with all kinds of additional files, course materials that you can download. It is really great. Some of the courses that I recommend you check out are things like shooting with the iPhone 5S. Yeah, I know we have the iPhone 6, but if you want to do iPhone photography, it's really the same, whether you have a 5, a 5S, a 4. Ben Long has a great course on that. You've got designing the web, building websites with responsive. That means making them work on mobile. There's a whole course on using SVG images and how that can benefit you with your responsive design. So if you're into web design, you might want to check that out. iPads and education. I know a lot of you are educators. Maybe you're an IT person in an education environment. They have a whole course on deploying one-to-one iPads, which is a really tricky thing to do, but very powerful once you understand it. And this is timely. They have a new course up and running with the Apple Watch. So if you've got an Apple Watch and you just want to get up to speed with everything that it can do, all of the features and functionality, there's a great video tutorial on that. I've been taking lynda.com courses for a long time. I do WordPress development. I'm constantly looking for things to help me with that. And right now there is a whole course on developing with Sass and Grunt.js, two things that I have been curious about. I've actually done some work with Sass, and I use the CodeKit application for compiling my SAS, but I know a lot of people use Grunt, so I wanted to know more about that. Went on lynda.com, found a course, and I've been digging into that. So learning a little bit more about the command line tool. And also in that same course, they have some more information about underscores, which is a starter theme. And so I'm learning about that in the process. So it's a perfect way for me to get in and expand some of my existing skills and move into some new areas that I wasn't in before. And lynda.com can do that for you. And with your membership, you get access to all of the tutorials taught by experts, thousands of streaming courses. You can get them on demand, watch them on your own schedule. You can learn at your own pace because everything's broken up into little bits and pieces. So you can dive in, go through a whole course all at once, or take it on one bit of a time at a time if you are, you know, pressed for time and you just don't have that much time. They have downloads that you can do for your iOS and Android devices if you have that kind of plan, and you can create and share playlists and, you know, sort of build up your library of things that you want to learn and watch. And you can also share those with friends and colleagues and things like that. So your lynda.com membership is going to give you unlimited access to all of the topics, all of the tutorials, all for one flat rate. So whether you're looking to become an industry expert, you're just passionate about your hobby, or you want to learn something new, I want you to try lynda.com. Visit lynda.com/MacCast and you can sign up for a free 10-day trial. So you can try it out completely free, 10 days, see if you're going to like it. I know you are, though. So that's lynda.com, lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the show. Well, let's get into finding out what's under the hood of those new Apple Watches that are slowly trickling out there. I've had mine for a while. I'm absolutely loving it. But recently, there have been sites doing different teardowns, x-rays. We've got iFixit pulling it apart, and they literally had to rip it apart at one point. You get down in there. I mean, this thing is compact. There's tons of wires. They ended up just having to kind of break it and then go back in. I think they're going to go back in now and try and figure out how to do it more daintily. But they just wanted to get in and look at the guts. Chipworks did their x-rays. This week, though, finally, one of the companies, Abbey Research, did a decapitation of the S1 chip. So that's the main, I guess, everything. I was going to say processor, but it's really more than the processor. It's the entire heart of the Apple Watch beyond the battery and the haptic engine. So your CPU, GPU, RAM, everything is contained inside that S1 chip, and it's all sort of encapsulated in like a resin. So it's all one piece. So really, to get in there beyond doing an x-ray, all you can do is sort of grind it down, or, you know, strip it apart, do a decapitation of the chip. And what we learned is some pretty interesting things. One, there's a brand new application processor in there, the Apple APL0778 application processor, made by Samsung. That wasn't too surprising, but it's using an older 28 nanometer process. So they're not doing the smallest nanometer, which you might think with the Apple Watch being so tiny and wanting to get to be super power efficient, they might be going with a smaller nanometer process, but they didn't. And for comparison, the A8 is a 20 nanometer chip. So found that interesting in the manufacturing side of things. Also, when they tore it down, the battery is super small. The 38 millimeter version of the Apple Watch has a 3.8 volt, 205 milliamp hour battery. Something that is good news for people who may want to replace their own displays. The display and digitizer assembly looks relatively easy to replace. You do kind of have to heat up some of the glue and pry it off, and there is like a ring sort of glue seal that would need to be replaced, but it looks like you can already get that as a replacement part from some of the do-it-yourself, fix-it repair shops, and the whole digitizer display is all one kind of sealed unit. So shouldn't be too hard to change that, or the battery for that matter. So that's good news for longevity on the Apple Watch. iFixit did note when they tore it down that it does have teeny tiny tri-wing screws, and as a matter of fact, they had to modify their special tool. So Apple's still sticking with kind of the really specialized screws, so you are going to need a special kind of toolkit if you really want to get in there. And the parts are all really, really tiny. I think that's not surprising in, considering the size of the Apple Watch itself. The haptic engine uses a tiny linear actuator, so it's actually a little unit that slides back and forth, unlike your traditional vibration motor, which would sort of spin around. Another really cool component that's in there is the accelerometer gyroscope. It is a six-axis accelerometer gyroscope, but it's all in a single packaged component. And that is totally unique to the Apple Watch as a product. None of Apple's other devices use a single six-axis accelerometer and gyroscope unit. So that's brand new. Something that's also different is the RAM. I think we had already kind of heard there was 512 megabytes of RAM in the watch, which, just for comparison, that's about the same as the iPhone 4. But it's not using the same type of RAM that we're used to seeing. Typically, we see DRAM or dynamic RAM. The Apple Watch actually uses static RAM, and I'm not sure what the difference is. I haven't had time to look into this. So if you happen to be a memory person, somebody who knows a little bit about this, what, you know, just in plain English, I'd be curious to know what the difference between SRAM and DRAM is and why you might choose to use one over the other. Specifically, why would Apple to choose to go with the static RAM in something like the Apple Watch? And like I said, that processor, the APL0778 application processor, they call it an APU, application processor unit, not just a CPU, because I believe, and it seems to be the case, that the GPU functions and the CPU functions are kind of all in one unit. And Steve Troughton-Smith noted that the Apple Watch firmware seems to use a PowerVR SGX 543 driver, which would be the driver for the same GPU that was originally found in the Apple A5 processor. So that would be the same processor as the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S. So the assumption would be that it would have about the same kinds of graphics capabilities as like an iPad 2 in a tiny Apple Watch. That amazes me. I don't know. That little figure thought, that's a lot of GPU power for something really that small. If it truly can kind of do that much processing, would be amazing. And holds a lot of hope, I think, maybe for when we start to see some native apps that are third-party apps. You know, that Apple's done some pretty cool things. Although, as you'll hear later, some of the design specs and the UI specs came out for the Apple Watch, and developers are going to be a little bit limited, I think, on the graphic size side for a number of various reasons. So along with all these teardowns and things like that, we're also starting to get some of the reports on component parts, and people try to break out the cost of the components and try and infer sort of what the profit margin is within these components. So IHS, iSupply, tore everything down. They estimated the component costs of a 38-millimeter Apple Watch Sport, and they gave it a number of $81.20, which would mean, so they claim, that the Apple Watch is one of the highest profit margin pieces of Apple hardware, considering that it has just, that the component cost, if their number was accurate, is just about 24% of the $349 selling price. The thing is it's highly questionable how accurate those numbers are. They break down individual components, things like the display they say is $20.50 US. They priced out the S1 processor at $10.20 in terms of the component cost. But what they're not thinking about is a lot of the other factors that go into this, plus all of the things like R&D. Their data, as a matter of fact, directly contradicts a statement that Tim Cook made during the second quarter earnings call, where he said that Apple Watch margins are going to be actually lower than the company average. So iSupply is saying it's going to be some of the highest margins. Tim's saying, no, they're actually going to be a little bit lower. And he actually spoke about some of these component breakdowns and costs that are getting out there and said, you know, really, they're bogus. They're completely inaccurate. And that's because, you know, Apple works closely with their manufacturing partners, as you can see from us going over some of these components. They custom develop or completely engineer brand new components. The R&D alone that goes into that is going to significantly drive up the cost. So you can't just look at the silicone and comparable chips and components and things like that and sort of infer what the price is. A lot of this stuff is really custom work. And then they leave things out too. Like in the component cost, I didn't see what is the cost of the casings, the aluminum or the stainless steel casings, and fabricating those. And in many instances, Apple is not only designing the parts, they're designing custom machines and manufacturing processes. None of that stuff is accounted for. And also what's not accounted for is advertising and software costs, distribution. None of those things are factored into these numbers. So you really can't kind of put a lot of stock in these. They're interesting to sort of talk about and look at, but you know, I wouldn't you know, take them to the bank. And I think Apple's certainly telling you don't do that. So it'll be, you know, we'll have more kind of detail, although Apple's not going to break out in their next quarterly results call the actual, you know, how many units of the Apple Watch they sold. I think they're grouping them all in a category called other, which I think is going to include now iPods and some other components. So it's going to be hard for us to infer exactly how successful or how much profit Apple is actually generating from the watch. But just based on demand and things that we've been hearing, the numbers should be pretty good. Apple has likely sold 3 million or so watches by this point and will probably sell a lot more. And that's a lot more smartwatches than a lot of other manufacturers. One of the components that is one of those custom components is the Taptic engine. And it turns out that that little thing, that little linear actuator, may be the one thing that has stood between you and your Apple Watch. Slice Intelligence last week predicted that as many as 1.7 million watches might have been initially pre-ordered, and that about only 22% as of last week had actually shipped out. And if you look on Apple's website, some of the 42 millimeter watch shipments, like the Space Gray Sport, and I think I was looking at the Space Black Sport this week, those shipping estimates have slipped into July. There's some speculation that the 42 millimeter models are a little bit more popular than the 38 millimeter, and that, you know, that might be because the 38 millimeter is too small for a lot of people. I have a 38 millimeter, and I'm going to say I have to disagree with that. And I think this was something that Slice Intelligence was commenting on. So I read about that, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think a lot of people think the 42 millimeter is the right size, but I would encourage you, if you're shopping, that you go in, do a try-on, try them both on. Ultimately, I think for me, I like the 42 millimeter size a little bit better, but depending upon the size of your wrist, things like that, you might find that the smaller one's more comfortable. So I think that's just early shipments. People didn't know what to order. You didn't have a chance to try them on. So I think a lot of people erred toward the bigger one, which is causing those to be a little bit more delayed, it seems like, than the 38 millimeter. But now things do seem to be picking up in terms of shipments. Some folks are actually getting their units earlier than expected. Some people who were supposed to be getting them in June are already starting to receive their shipments. So things are getting better. And there are signs on Apple's website that they may even be getting close to allowing in-store pickups. That option started to show up this week. So if you go on the Apple Store, it's in there, but it's grayed out. But before, you didn't even see that option on Apple's website. So there's a lot of speculation about why the shortage is. You know, was Apple waiting to do just-in-time ordering so they could see what the breakdown was? But a lot of the blame seems to be coming back to the Taptic engine. And this is because the Wall Street Journal ran a piece saying that they discovered that one of the companies manufacturing the Taptic engines, Apple has two suppliers, I guess, for it, AAC Technologies Holdings, supposedly supplied units that started failing during reliability testing. So right in the run-up to taking the pre-orders, they suddenly started seeing these units fail in the reliability testing. And so Apple completely scrapped all of those units. It's not clear if they were ever put into watches or if Apple had to disassemble them. We don't really know what went on behind the scenes. Good news is it sounds like they never shipped. So it's not like if you got an Apple Watch, you might have a faulty Taptic engine in yours. It sounds like they never even really made it into those units. We even heard, if you remember John Gruber's review, he mentioned that he received a unit that had a, you know, pre-production or pre-release unit that had a faulty Taptic engine in it. He had to send it back and Apple replaced it. So it may have been, that may have been one of the signs that sort of triggered Apple to look into the Taptic engines a little bit more before they actually started shipping them out. But in case you're wondering, you know, what's taking so long, that might be the case. And it sounds like Apple's getting a handle on that because we're starting to see shipments ship out a little bit more quickly. So hang in there. Even if you have a later date, you might get lucky and you might get it a little bit earlier than expected. Few more odds and ends on the Apple Watch that I wanted to jump into. The heart rate sensor, there's the whole what some are calling tattoo gate, where it won't work through some dark tattoos. If you're not aware of how the technology for the heart rate sensor sort of works, there's a couple of different LEDs on the back of the Apple Watch. Two green ones that actually sort of do a reading through your skin to actually get your heart rate. And Apple has acknowledged that certain darker, more opaque pigment tattoos, if you have a wrist tattoo, it's not going to be able to get through that and give you an accurate reading. This kind of blew up in the media. I don't see it as being a real huge problem. You have two wrists, so hopefully if you have wrist tattoos, you don't have really dark ink on both sides. And it really is only for people who have really dark pigment tattoos. So if you are in that kind of situation where you do have wrist tattoos and you're considering an Apple Watch, you might want to go in, do a try-on appointment, see if you can get them to, I know they only have the demos running, maybe they'll make an exception and you can get them to sort of test out the sensor, or maybe borrow one from a friend who has an Apple Watch and see how it goes. As far as the sensor itself, it's been extensively tested in several places, and I've read several articles that have pointed out that it is pretty accurate. As a matter of fact, there was a recent report that said they tested it against one of the most accurate top-rated wristband heart rate sensors on the market, and the Apple Watch seemed to be able to almost match the quality of that. And I've also seen reports that the most accurate kind of heart rate sensor you can get, I guess, is the one that sort of straps on your chest. It's been compared to that, not as accurate, but again, pretty accurate when even compared to the sort of chest heart rate sensors. So getting good reviews on that part of the Apple Watch. I mentioned that Apple also did release the developer guidelines for not only watch apps and the UI guidelines for that, but also they released the guidelines for third-party bands. So that's good news. We assumed that Apple was going to allow third-party bands, but this is pretty much confirmation that they're going to let developers create those. One interesting note that came up this week, too, though, is if you don't want to wait on third-party bands to come out or some of those adapters, if you have one of the Apple Watches that has either the classic or the modern buckle bands, you can actually put your own band onto those, because the way the mechanism works, it has a little slide-in unit on the watch side, and then it has a little bar. Turns out that little bar is connected just on the back with some pentalobe screws. So if you have a pentalobe screwdriver, you can undo that. You can slide your own band on and put that back together. Probably an expensive way to go if you didn't get a watch already with the classic modern buckle, because I think those bands are $149 US themselves. So you'd basically be buying a $149 band adapter to slide on your own third-party band. There's going to be cheaper ones. As far as the guidelines for creating those, Apple has a new Creating Bands for Apple Watch article on their developer website. And the guidelines spell out some things, including what the requirements will be to achieve Apple certification for their new Made for Apple Watch program. So you will be able to get a certification, or manufacturers will be able to get a certification so they can get the little logo. One of the things that is going to be required is that you are going to have to use, to get the certification, Apple Watch lugs. And the lug, I believe, is the little unit when you push the button on the back of your Apple Watch, it pushes up on the lug, which is this little metal thing in the middle of the band. And it's the thing that facilitates sort of it locking into the Apple Watch when you slide the band in there. So they are going to have to buy those from Apple. And there are very specific guidelines on the design and placement of those within the latching mechanism within the band. So you're going to have to meet those specifications. They're also saying things like they're not going to allow integrating of any magnetic chargers. So some of those magnetic charging bands that we saw probably are not going to be allowed. You're not going to be able to cover up or interfere with any of the watch's functions. So you can't have something that goes over the glass or that blocks the side button or the digital crown functionality. Nothing that's going to cover up the heart rate sensors, as a matter of fact. Bands that would prevent the user's skin from maintaining contact directly with the heart rate sensor, those are not going to be allowed. So if the band has sort of any shifting or pushes the face of the watch or the back of the watch up off of your wrist, those are not going to be qualifying for certification either. So good news is they are going to allow bands, but developers are certainly going to have to adhere with sort of these guidelines. The other thing is the developer UI guidelines. Apple put out a lot of information for developers with regard to that. I just want to talk about some of the things that I found interesting. Third-party apps are not going to be allowed to just present the time. So that sort of rules out not necessarily custom watch faces, because, you know, that's something completely separate. Apple has their own custom watch faces. It's unclear at this point if Apple's going to open that up and allow developers to build custom watch faces that you'd be able to go in and customize, you know, with the force touch and things like that. But I think some people were thinking an end run around that might be, well, I can just build an Apple Watch app that just does time functionality. Apple's saying, no, that's not going to be allowed. They're also not going to allow any apps to have direct access to the digital crown or the side button. That functionality is going to have to remain the same. So by default, it'll still, in your third-party app, allow you, the digital crown, for example, allow you to do scrolling, but you're not going to be able to modify or change that functionality. And with the side button, I don't think developers have any access to that at all, because that's for accessing the digital touch and friends function, friends list function only, and that activates from, you know, anywhere you are within the watch interface. Something that was a little bit surprising in terms of the design, Apple is saying you have to use a black background for your app. So we're not going to see sort of white backgrounds with white text, I don't think. I think you can have a box sort of in the middle with a white background, but the absolute background of the app needs to sort of blend into the face of the Apple Watch. Apple wants to keep that consistent. It's also been pointed out that probably for power reasons, Apple wants you to have mostly a black interface or a darker interface, because that's going to use less energy, less battery on the watch. They also said that you need to avoid displaying the logo in your app, and you're not allowed to include any sort of launch screen. So to me, that says the design of your icon is going to be pretty important, because they don't want you to throw the logo in there, because you have such small space on the Apple Watch screen. They don't want you eating up that extra real estate that you could be using for your application interface. So I found those things particularly interesting in the UI guidelines. And, you know, there's more stuff in there. They go into typography and some of the other placement of elements and things like that. So if you're really interested in that, that stuff is up and available on Apple's developer website. You can go through and read through all of it. The last thing on the Apple Watch that I wanted to mention is there have been some reports of people having digital crowns that get stuck. So you might be building up skin oils, or some people have mentioned possibly sweat that then crystallizes underneath the digital crown and it gets stuck. Apple put out a tech article about that and said, hey, easy fix for that is just go ahead and rinse it underwater. You can run it underwater, fresh water, for 10 or 15 seconds. That will free it up, and you don't have to really worry about it. They do recommend that you turn off the watch first. So, you know, press and hold the side button until you get the power off option and go ahead and power it off. And then they also say remove the band if you have one of the leather bands or a band that you don't want to get wet, which I think is just common sense. And just so you know, the Apple Watch does have an IPX7 water resistance rating. So Apple has kind of said it's splash proof. They don't really recommend even showering with it. But the reality is if you look at the IPX7 water resistance rating, that says that the watch could be in up to a meter of water, so about 3.3 feet, I think it is, for up to 30 minutes and still be okay. I don't think I would dunk mine personally for that long, but It sounds like, and I think Tim Cook even commented that he showers with his Apple Watch. It sounds like you should be totally fine in that kind of scenario. Certainly, you're going to be fine to rinse it off once in a while and just clean it up a little bit. Some interesting things happened this week with regard to Apple Pay. Apple continues to expand Apple Pay. We had a little bit of a scare looking like one of the major supporters of Apple Pay may have gone away, and Apple continues to add new banks. First off, we've got Best Buy. They say they're going to start taking Apple Pay, which is really surprising. They're going to start with their Best Buy application, but they do say they're going to be rolling out Apple Pay into retail stores sometime later this year. And that's interesting because, and a pretty big deal, because Best Buy is a member of the Merchant Commerce Exchange, MCX, which is promoting the current C technology, which is trying to take on Apple Pay. And as a matter of fact, they sort of have language that blocks their members and retailers, if they are going to use the current C technology, from using any other kind of digital payment technology. So that means if Best Buy does choose to move forward with Apple Pay, they won't be taking current C, as far as I know. Now, they did say they are going to stay as members of the Merchant Commerce Exchange, but an interesting development there, and that's a pretty big retailer within the Merchant Commerce Exchange. So it'll be interesting to see if some of the other members kind of take note of that and maybe follow suit, depending upon the popularity and sort of uptake of Apple Pay. And I, you know, personally, I love Apple Pay. We were talking about this on the iOS show today. One thing I'm a little bit frustrated with is it's not clear at a lot of retailers when you walk in that whether or not they accept or take Apple Pay. There's not a lot of signage. Sometimes you'll even ask the employees. They don't really know. And then it's sort of like you feel awkward about even trying it in case there's a problem, especially if there's people in line behind you. And so I found oftentimes I'll want to maybe try Apple Pay or see if I can use Apple Pay at a retailer, and I'll just default to taking my wallet out and taking out my card and kind of going old school because I don't want to cause, you know, anybody to be hung up in line. And I think that is a problem for Apple. I think they're going to need to work harder with their partner, their retail partners especially, to start to get more awareness and branding in the store, whether that's training employees, letting them know how the system works, or just getting signage at the register or on the door out front. Apple does have a way for retailers to get a free set of stickers. As a matter of fact, I ordered up a set for myself just to see what it was like and see the process. And it's very easy. They can go on a special Apple website, fill out a form. You don't have to pay anything. They ship them free stickers and even an applicator. They give them a little guide on where to put the stickers. But I think Apple's going to need to get a little more proactive about that and probably actually just send the stickers out directly to their retail partners and hope that they'll actually apply them and put them up in their stores. I think that would go a long way to helping us out as consumers know, you know, what locations are actually accepting Apple Pay and where it will work. Because as a matter of fact, another thing that happened this week is Home Depot suddenly at some locations, it seemed like, stopped taking Apple Pay, and they had been taking Apple Pay. I used Apple Pay at Home Depot several times, and as a matter of fact, one time it really saved me because I was there, I put everything in my cart, even scanned through everything, and then realized I had completely forgotten my wallet. Luckily, I had my iPhone with me, and I was able to use Apple Pay and check out. And as a matter of fact, the person at the register was surprised. She's like, oh, that's really cool. I'd never seen anybody use that before. And it worked really, really well. Well, apparently, somebody had gone into some Home Depots and then posted on Reddit that a Home Depot where they had used Apple Pay before was sort of no longer taking it. And that caused a big upstir. A lot of people reporting that Home Depot was no longer taking Apple Pay, that it might be because of their partnership with PayPal. But luckily, a few hours later, they came back out and said, no, we're actually going through a process where we're replacing a lot of our equipment to actually support Apple Pay. And Home Depot is going to support Apple Pay in 2,000 of its locations. So I think that's going to make Home Depot actually one of the largest supporters or retail supporters of Apple Pay. So as you can tell or probably hear, I'm a big fan of Apple Pay. I'm hoping it becomes really successful. I enjoy using it. I think it works really well most of the time. I've had a few foibles here and there where it'll look like it reads. I get the little okay on my watch or my phone, and then the person at the register says, no, I didn't get it. What I've learned there is just a tip for you. Make sure you hold the Apple Pay down, even if it says okay on the phone. wait till you hear the beep. A lot of the systems, the readers, will actually make an audible beep when it actually transmits the information over to the register. So that's kind of your cue that, yes, everything actually did go through. But beyond that, I mean, it's quick and easy to pay, and I like it a lot. And so I'm hoping it continues to gain success and takes off. And the Best Buy deal and the Home Depot announcements are pretty good news this week that at least some major retailers are supporting Apple Pay. I think the other thing Apple really needs to get on top of with Apple Pay support, just as one last thing to talk about, is international support. I don't know why it's taking so long for something to show up in, say, Canada or the UK or even Australia, Japan. If Apple could get it in China, that would be awesome. I don't know what the challenges might be there. Those could be pretty big. But really, they need to start also to work on really getting it out in more countries, I think, for it to really get a big amount of traction. But I know they're having some issues working with banks and different companies in those regions, and hopefully they can get that stuff worked out shortly, and we'll see more Apple Pay everywhere. Another area where Apple has been struggling a little bit is with their tablet sales. Just in general, in the industry, tablet sales are slowing down. It's come up in the last quarterly results call. Tim addressed it, saying Apple's really not worried about it. And as a matter of fact, Apple's numbers are still really good in terms of overall percentage of the market. Apple sells more tablets than any other maker of tablets worldwide. This is according to the latest numbers from IDC Worldwide Quarterly, their tablet tracker. They had Apple with a 26.8% share of the global market in the first quarter of 2015, shipping about 12.6 million units. But even though they have the largest share, that's still a 23% decline in shipments year over year. So tablet sales are slowing down. I don't think this is really anything that unusual, and I don't think it's anything that's really surprising Apple, to be honest. Tablet sales were huge. They ramped up really, really quickly. I think it still was one of the fastest selling categories of product for Apple in their history. So they ramped up sales really, really quickly. A lot of people wanted iPads, but then I think the problem is you reached a stasis. We all had our iPads. Apple started iterating. We got some different models, the iPad Air, iPad 2, the Mini, and that helped a little bit. But ultimately, anybody who wanted an iPad or wanted a tablet sort of has it. And a lot of people are using them as PC supplements or even in some cases PC replacements. And I think we're going to fall more into a buying cycle that's more like desktops or laptops. So it's not the kind of product once you have a tablet that you're going to be buying into every year or maybe even every other year. It's probably on a 2, 3, maybe even 4 year upgrade cycle. So now that the market is sort of saturated, everybody who wants an iPad or a tablet has a tablet, you're going to fall into that more general sort of level of buying. So I think we're going to see this decline, and then I think we're going to sort of see tablet sales level out. And I don't know if there's much Apple can do to really juice that. Some people are putting faith in this iPad Pro thing, that Apple might do a larger version of the iPad, and maybe that could jump iPad sales up a little bit. But I'm not even sure I'm buying that, because to me, that seems like a really, really niche product. It's going to be for certain verticals, for certain types of customers. I'm thinking creative customers, specifically people who are into either photography or drawing, art, illustration, those sorts of things. The latest leaks that we're hearing came from a French blog, nowhereelse.fr. They reportedly found some newer specs on the screen. They're saying it could be as large as 12.9 inches, not the 12.2 inch display rumors that we had been hearing in the past. And that is big. I mean, that's bigger than your 11 inch iPad Air. Or iPad Air, your 11-inch MacBook Air, rather. That's going to be, I think, even probably bigger than the new MacBook in terms of, just the physical size of the display. So that is a big tablet. It's still reportedly going to have 4 speakers, so stereo sound. Other rumors include that it might have a 3-core A8X processor, so an additional core on the Apple processor, 2 gigabytes of RAM, and of course, Touch ID. Probably maybe even Force Touch. There's also been some speculation that it would come with an Apple stylus or would have an Apple stylus as an accessory that would offer up pressure sensitivity. So that would be more for your illustrators, people who are artists and stuff like that. And again, I've heard Force Touch and even NFC being thrown around, along with possibly using the USB-C connector to replace the Lightning connector. And in case you're wondering, you know, why would you want NFC? Because a lot of people think NFC, that means Apple Pay. Why would you want Apple Pay in a 13-inch tablet? I'm not going to carry that thing around and make payments with it. The NFC is more the other way around. So where the iPad Pro could potentially become an Apple Pay register. So you would be able to actually use Apple Pay from your phone and tap it to the iPad Pro to actually make a purchase, which that would be one of those sort of verticals that I was talking about where it would make a lot of sense for kind of a product like an iPad Pro, or I'm also thinking like kiosks and, you know, museum information screens. Those sorts of things would be in that vertical. I just don't think that's going to really pump up or juice tablet sales. I really think we're just going to get to the point in pretty quickly here where the iPad is just one of those staple products like the Mac, like MacBooks and MacBook Pros in Apple's lineup. And there's not going to be a lot of fluctuation year over year in those numbers. You know, just like the Mac, we see every quarter pretty religiously 4 to 5 million units sold. I think the iPad's going to fall into that category. What that number is going to be, I don't know. I'm going to guess somewhere around that 9, 10 to 13 million units a quarter. And that's going to be the common number we hear reported when Apple gives their quarterly results. Last thing I want to talk about in the news for today is some of the media and media service updates we've been hearing around Apple. Apple TV is still one of those big things being pushed for a possible update and announcements around WWDC. As a matter of fact, Time Warner CEO Jeffrey Bukes says that Apple is, quote, very forward-thinking about television, and he is pretty confident that Apple will be launching not only an Apple TV, but a subscription streaming TV service in the near future. We've been hearing a lot about that. Apple has supportedly been in talks for a while with different providers. In the quarterly results call, as a matter of fact, Tim Cook commented that he sees major, major changes in media, television, and he hinted that Apple would be the company bringing about those changes. The current thinking in the rumor mill is Apple wants to put together a streaming TV service with a monthly price of about $30 to $40 a month and a handful of select partner channels and content and stuff like that. So we have that going there. The Apple TV is expected to be refreshed with some new hardware also revealed around WWDC. On the hardware side, we're hearing probably we'll have an A8 processor, may come with a new app store. So we'll finally be able to get apps and games and stuff like that that we can custom install on the Apple TV, and also Siri voice controls. I'm also really hoping that we're going to hear something surrounding HomeKit and home automation. Although, honestly, between you and me, it's feeling like HomeKit is dead in the water, right? There was kind of this big buzz around it. I was very excited about it. And they are just dragging their feet in getting HomeKit products out to market. And I don't know if that's Apple or their partners or what's going on, if it's taking the certification. I know we just got the chips from Broadcom that were coming out a few months ago, so maybe that slowed things down. But it's really feeling like we need an announcement to juice up HomeKit and really make that a thing. And I'm hoping that's going to come along with the Apple TV. Another bit of hardware that's being rumored to be updated with the Apple TV is the remote. What they're saying is that Apple's going to replace the little sort of round orientation of buttons and the select button with a touchpad on the remote. So it would still have the play, pause, and menu buttons, but that lower part of the remote would be replaced with some sort of touchpad. I'm not entirely certain how I feel about that. I kind of like the physical buttons and design of the Apple remote. Having a little touch area, I don't know if it would be designated out like the, you know, like the Force Touch trackpad or something like that. I haven't heard anybody say that it's actually going to have Force Touch. I haven't heard any rumors saying that it would be a screen, although it'd be nice if you actually had a display, a Force Touch display on there with touch technology, but that may be a little bit much for a remote. At that point, Apple might just say, well, grab your Apple Watch or your iPhone and use the remote app. But I'm thinking sort of a scaled down version of the remote app on a nice OLED screen on the remote. As a matter of fact, the designer Martin Hajek did some really neat Apple TV designs and remote designs that were, you know, the whole front was basically like a glass touchscreen. They look really, really gorgeous, but that may be taking a little bit too far. I don't think that's what's going on here. We're looking at probably the stainless steel Apple remote just with this touchpad area. I don't know. Does that make the controller better? Doesn't feel like it to me. But more immediately on the Apple TV front, Apple did update the software on Apple TVs. They shipped out a couple more new channels. We now have in the States, CBS Sports and USA Now. USA Now is like on-demand USA content. If you have that as part of your cable package, you can lock into that. CBS Sports has sports and highlights and things like that. I think you can also tie that into your television subscription, cable subscription, if you have that. And then if you're outside the U.S., in Canada, France, or Germany, you also might have seen some new channels. Canadians got Crave TV and ShowMe, and French and German users received a channel called, and I'm probably going to mutilate the name, Arte. So, you know, update your Apple TVs and you might have a couple new channels there. And then the other thing that we have on the media front is the rumors about Apple's updated Beats music service and Apple possibly bringing out a streaming music service that's branded under their own brand. Rumors have been that for a while now that they've been in talk with the music labels and that they're getting pretty close to reaching some deals, but there still are some sticking points. And something happened this week that caused Apple to, or at least for us to hear that Apple might be getting some unwanted attention based on some of the talks they've been having with those music labels. There's been reports that Apple is asking some of the labels to pressure services like Spotify to no longer offer free tier service levels, to go paid only, and to kind of force them in that direction when they come up for contract renewals. Now, that would not be a good thing because you're not allowed to do that sort of thing. And what's been happening is places like the European Commission have started investigations over these allegations. So they started looking at Apple's business. And we've been down this road before, if you remember. Apple got slapped, whether you believe it or not, for this kind of behavior over the iBooks sort of deals that they had done with book publishers. So I find it hard to believe that Apple would be going down this road again. I would think they would be ultra careful how they were talking to labels and really avoid this kind of scrutiny, but it is going on. And it would have a big impact on some of their competitors' business. As a matter of fact, I was reading a report that said about one quarter of Spotify's 60 million customers are actually paid customers. So the other, three quarters of their business is from these free services. So cutting that off would be a really big impact. But, you know, if Apple is sort of pushing the labels to do that, that's not really good. And in the U.S., it's supposedly bringing the attention of the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission. So I think that's not really something that Apple wants at this point. Again, this is early stage stuff. I think they're just asking questions. They're talking to the labels, trying to find out what was going on. But if they do find something, it could be possible that we could see another lawsuit brought and Apple could be in hot water again. I'm really hoping that there's really nothing to this and that it's just sort of hearsay, but we'll have to wait and find out. Another thing that Spotify is a little bit upset with Apple and complaining about and asking to be investigated is Apple's sort of policies that give them a price advantage over services like Spotify, specifically with regards to selling apps in the App Store. And the issue is, and we've heard this before, the 30% cut of in-app purchases and subscriptions that Apple takes. Spotify is saying, well, we have to charge $13 a month for our premium subscription service, which you can buy regularly for $10 other places, because Apple is forcing this 30% cut. And so thereby, by doing that, that means if Apple releases their own app or their own service, they can undercut Spotify's price because, you know, Apple doesn't have to pay themselves that 30%. So kind of a legitimate argument. I don't know how that one's going to shake out either. I'm also not sure how I feel about that because, you know, Apple is providing a service. It is providing these services. And you do have the alternatives. I can go buy a Spotify subscription on the Spotify website and then I would assume still use the app. So you're not locked into sort of buying through the Spotify app to get the subscription, at least as far as I know. If I'm wrong on that, please let me know. But I don't think that's the case. So they may or may not have an argument there, but just another area with regards to Apple streaming media service where they might be having trouble. But supposedly they're trying to work rapidly to close these music deals so they can announce the new service in June. One sticking point with the labels seems to be price. Apple reportedly wanted to get a $7.99 per month subscription service, but the labels have been pushing back pretty hard on that one. So it's looking like Apple's going to give in and go back to kind of the standardized $9.99 a month price, which most of these streaming music services use. Apple's big advantage, of course, is that they have a very large customer base using iTunes and using their services and devices. So they're trying to use that leverage to get a little bit better deal. Hopefully they can get a better deal on the licensing, and that'll help, you know, their profits. I guess Apple should be a little bit happy about sort of charging a little bit more because that probably means more profit for them. Apple's own service, it's being reported, will not have any kind of free tier, which may be, again, where some of these rumors about Apple kind of pressuring the labels to not have free tiers on other services, wanting to kind of level the playing field. And that's, again, sort of the behavior that they got accused of with the books thing, right? They wanted to be able to sort of have the best pricing better than their competitors and were pushing the book labels and things to do price changes or renegotiate contracts with some of the other booksellers. They don't want to be doing that. I don't think they're going to fall in that trap again with music, but they're not going to have a free service, but it is being reported that there will be maybe longer trial periods so people can come into the service, try it for maybe up to as long as 3 months. They're also saying that they're going to give the artists and record labels the ability to offer some portion of their catalogs for free on the service. So you would not necessarily have a free subscription service, but you might be able to open up the app and listen to certain tracks or certain songs, maybe promotional stuff for free without actually having to have a subscription. So an interesting way to go. And I don't know if that'd be enough to kind of hook people in and then maybe get them to try out, you know, a trial of the service and then maybe eventually buy into it. I've never been big on streaming music services. I do use iTunes Radio and I like that a lot. I don't know if I would ultimately end up, I tried out Beats and I liked it, but frankly, I think I just don't listen to enough music to make it worthwhile for me. But I know a lot of people are really excited about the streaming music service. On the iTunes Radio front, there is some good news too, related to the announcements of the new streaming music service. So even if you're not into streaming music, if you're more interested in iTunes Radio, it's sounding like in June, alongside the release of iOS 8.4 and probably iTunes 12.2, that Apple will finally get iTunes Radio in more countries. I haven't seen a specific list of which countries, but that is good news. And along with that, it's also being said that they may move to more human curation of the radio stations that people create, supposedly headed up by an effort among some of the staff and DJs from BBC Radio 1 that Apple reportedly recently hired. So those guys are going to be working on more human curated content for iTunes Radio. That will hopefully make your radio stations more accurate and you'll get more relevant sort of suggestions and things to go along with your stations. And that has been one complaint about iTunes Radio. I have found that if you just like and sort of add artists and songs to your stations over time, they get better naturally just through the robotic algorithms, I guess, that Apple is using, but a little bit more human curation certainly can't hurt, I don't think. So hopefully iTunes Radio will be in more countries and get more accurate here in the coming months. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, if you want to get a new Apple Watch and you need a little bit of extra cash, what about selling one of your older devices? Maybe you've got an old iPad or an iPhone lying around. Gazelle wants to give you cash for your current devices. And what I love about Gazelle is they make it super easy to get the money so that you can upgrade and purchase new stuff. They give you a fair upfront offer right there on their website. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com. They'll even buy broken devices, so you can get an offer on those. And basically what you do is you go to the website, you find the device that you want to sell back, and you tell them a little bit about the condition. And then right there on the screen, they will give you an upfront offer for your gadgets. And they even offer free shipping, and in many cases will provide a box. So if you take the offer, they can send you the box. When you receive it, you send it in, you package it up, and once they receive it, they just check it out. Make sure it's in the condition you said it was, has the accessories you said it had with it, and then you get paid fast by check, by PayPal, or by Amazon gift card. And if you choose the Amazon gift card option, you even get 5% more on your offer. The whole process literally takes minutes, so do it today because every day you wait, your gadgets may lose value. And plus, you can lock in your offer, so that can give you a little bit of time if you need to make a new purchase before sending in your old one. And Gazelle has handled over 2 million trade-ins, paid out over $175 million to customers, and over 90% of people using Gazelle report having an excellent experience. And I'm definitely in that group. So what are you waiting for? Take a minute, find out what your old iPhone, iPad, or other devices are worth. Just go to gazelle.com to find out now. And a big thank you to Gazelle for their support of the MacCast. One of the complaints that has been levied against the Apple Watch is that a lot of the functionality is reliant on being tethered to an iPhone. You need to have an iPhone, I think 5 or later, to launch apps, to do a number of the features. But one of the things that I was curious about when we started hearing about rumors of the Apple Watch was, what kinds of functions would actually work without being tethered? And now that the watch has been out for a little bit and people have been able to play around with it, we're starting to get some of that information. So I thought we'd kind of go over some of the features and functionality that you can actually get with your Apple Watch that don't require it being tethered to the phone. I think probably the most obvious would be that you can still get the time without being tethered to the phone. I think to get time updates, you still need to probably be near Wi-Fi or tethered to your phone, but you will be able to just get the time even if you don't have your phone nearby. Another thing that is surprising is that it can actually still track your move, exercise, and stand progress. I guess it's not that surprising because it's going to use the onboard, sensors, the accelerometers, the gyroscopes, those sorts of things to track that information. And then it can store it and then sync it back to your device and to health when you get back in range of your phone. You can also do things like check your heart rate because, of course, it has the onboard heart rate sensors. Where it gets interesting with the movement and tracking stuff is when you do workouts, specifically like running or walking outdoor workouts. Because it turns out that while if you have your phone with you, it'll be able to use the GPS on your phone to track things like distance. You can actually train it or sort of get the watch to learn your stride and for both walking and running. And then after that, if your phone isn't nearby, it can use that information that it knows to actually guesstimate how far you've gone based on time, I would assume, during a workout, a running workout or a walking workout. And the best way to get that to work is to sort of calibrate it with your phone on you. So what I've been reading is that if you spend at least 20 minutes doing an outdoor walk or run, so you're going to go into the activity app, you're going to pick an outdoor walk or an outdoor run, whether you're walking or running, take your phone with you, and then you want to go as much as possible in a straight line. So it's probably a good thing if you can go out to a track or someplace where you can go pretty straight, maybe out on the beach, something like that, and spend at least 20 minutes walking or running. And then that will improve the step and distance accuracy of the watch when you're away from your phone and it's not going to have to rely on the GPS. You can also listen to music. This was something we knew about a little bit before the Apple Watch came out. There is a way to sync up to 2 gigabytes of music to your watch. And the way you do this is you go into the watch app and you go into the music settings and select a playlist out of your iTunes library or your music library that you can sync over to the device. And then you can choose how much storage you want to use up to 2 gigabytes. I think the minimum I want to say is 500 megabytes, something like that. And then it will sync that music over to the local storage on the watch. There's 8 gigabytes of total storage on the watch, but you can designate 2 gigabytes for music. Unfortunately, you cannot play the music through the built-in speaker on the watch. I would assume some of that's for power reasons. Some of it is also because the speaker is literally so tiny. I don't know that you could really hear it. It works for doing a phone call in a quiet room, but I don't know if it would be all that great for listening to music. So what you would do for actually listening is pair a set of Bluetooth headphones or earbuds to the watch to be able to listen to your music. You can also look at your photos that have been synced into the in the watch under the Photos application. Again, this is similar to how you would define music that you want to sync over. You go into the Apple Watch app, and then you set up a synced album. By default, it's going to be the favorites album. And then you would also define the amount of storage you want to use up on your Apple Watch for photos, between 5 megabytes and 75 megabytes, or roughly between 25 to 500 photos. So you can store up to 500 photos locally on your watch, and then you don't need to be near your phone to be able to access those photos. If you are near the phone, you're going to have access to the entire photo library that's on your device. And then beyond that, there's just general cached data. So you might have data from recently viewed applications, things like mail, calendar, messages. If those things are in cache, you can still open up those apps and get at that data. Same goes for any third-party apps that might have a little bit of local cached storage in them. And then really good news if you use Apple Pay is you do not need to have your phone to use Apple Pay. As long as your credit card is already loaded into the device, and again, that's something I think we discussed this, that you have to do individually from the Apple Watch app. Those don't sync over from your phone. You have to go back and re-add in your cards. I think that's because the secure enclave between the iPhone and the watch can't transmit that information because of the security restrictions. So you physically need to re-add your cards back into the watch one by one. But then once they're in there, you can double tap the side button, bring them up in Apple Pay, and then use those to make payments. So that, as far as I know, is the extent of what you can do when you're not tethered to the phone. Everything else, I think, requires tethering. If I missed anything, let me know. I don't think I did, but I think that's a pretty good bit of functionality that you can do without being tethered. Another thing I wanted to talk about related to the Apple Watch is understanding movement. And I don't mean movement of the hands because those are digital, right? You know, but a lot of times when you're talking watches, you think watch movement, you know, that's how the thing functions. What I'm talking about is being confused about receiving credit for exercise and movement when I really didn't think that I maybe deserved it or even earned it. So you might notice as you're just wearing your watch around the house and sitting and moving around that the movement rings and things will start to fill up. And I was a little bit confused by this, but luckily the folks over at iMore kind of came to the rescue to clear up some of the confusion. So they broke it down into the three areas: the standing area, which I think is one of the areas most people are having the most confusion, the exercise area, and the move area. I'll link to the full article over at iMore in the show notes at mattcast.com. But with standing, for example, and you've probably, if you have an Apple Watch, you've experienced this, or if you get one, you might, you'll notice that sometimes you'll actually be standing and up will pop the little, hey, you need to move around or you need to stand message, I guess is what it says. And what iMore pointed out is really that should be move around. And because if you're stationary, even in a standing position for too long, you can get that notification. So where this has come up is people who use standing desks, they'll be standing at their desk, but just typing on the keyboard for hours and hours. that's still going to trigger the stand notification. And it's really telling you, hey, move around for at least 60 seconds, walk around the house, get some movement, get the blood pumping and flowing. And that's just a good, healthy thing. And typically that's why too, that notification will come up about 10 minutes before the hour. So if you haven't moved around enough in that past hour, it'll give you time to kind of still get credit for that hour before it flips over to the next one. So if you've been wondering, hey, I was standing already, why am I getting this message? That probably is why. And I think I have seen a couple false positives where I have been moving around, but I think also too there, it's the amount of total amount of movement you've done over an hour or a couple of hours. So it's sort of aggregating that information. And if you've only moved a little bit, it's basically saying, hey, you need to move around a little bit more. And typically just walking around the house or doing a little bit of activity for about 60 seconds will be enough to trigger and give you the credit for that. Exercise is another one of those things. And it's looking like exercise is going to be defined as anything above sort of a brisk walk. And that can be a lot of different activities. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you've gone to the gym or you went out for a run. You could be doing something like doing yard work or just cleaning around the house. If it's enough activity to bring your heart rate up above the beats per minute that a brisk walk would, then that will qualify as exercise. And I'm not entirely sure how Apple calculates the heart rate that you need to qualify, but some of the information that you might initially put into the Apple Watch are your weight and height. So I think it uses some of that information. The iMore piece is the Apple Watch will also kind of learn your habits and adjust that credit level accordingly. So if you're the type of person who exercises a lot, you're going to need to do a percentage more to get to that higher level. If you're a little more sedentary, it's going to be a similar percentage, but obviously that's going to mean less movement or less activity. And I think the reason they set it up this way is really to encourage you to do more than you are already doing. So you wouldn't want the kind of situation where you take somebody who doesn't do a lot of exercise and you're suddenly pushing them to do a ton. You just want to incrementally do more and more and more. And I would imagine the more that you do, that target will slide up over time, which is ultimately, I think, a good thing as well. And then the last bit of data is just that move data. And you'll notice this ring fills up pretty quickly because it's just based on general moving around. And it also does calculate your sort of calorie goal, or it's the calorie goal that you set. And it's based on how much you move and your heart rate to determine kind of the calorie count. And it actually separates calories into just those kind of resting calories, the stuff you'd burn just being alive and sitting around, from actual active calories. And your move goal is a target for active calories. And the most other fitness trackers, and I think where this is getting confusing for a lot of other people, most other fitness trackers or apps and things like that use total calories burned. So they're trying to get you to a total calorie goal. The move goal in the Apple Watch app is really just for those active calories. And you can actually use the activity app on your iPhone to get a lot more detail on the stats. So if you've just been looking at the stats in the Apple Watch, it gives you a general overview and kind of a couple of touch points. But if you want to see the full history of all your days, the review of all your awards, more detail on the kinds of calories that you're burning and stuff like that, you're going to want to open up the activity app that is on your iPhone to get all of that detail. But hopefully that kind of helps explain how Apple is kind of calculating these different touch points, because I think it can be a little bit confusing, especially if you've been using some other app. I know I was confused at first, but it makes a little more sense to me now. And the last thing I want to talk about with respect to the watch is just some general tips and things that I've learned since getting the Apple Watch about a week and a half, or I guess almost 2 weeks ago now. A lot of them related to using Force Touch. And that's just a general tip, I think, that I've mentioned before, is that when in doubt, try a Force Touch and see if you can't get some additional information. It's almost like, you know, the right click or the control click on your Mac. So here's some interesting things you can do with force touches. You may or may not know that if you force touch the heart or the face animated emoji, in the digital touch section, you can actually change their color. So with the heart, you can change it between red and blue and purple. And with the faces, they can be yellow or red. And you just force touch and it will change the color. In the stopwatch application, it will activate a couple of different view modes. So you can get like a graph or different kinds of digital readouts, analog readouts, and those sorts of things. And you can switch those by force touching on the stopwatch app. One that I like and use quite frequently is if you swipe to pull down your notifications. So if you get the little red dot, right, and you want to review your notifications and you have a few of them backed up in there and you just want to clear all of them, if you use a force touch, it will give you a clear all option and you can quickly dismiss all of those notifications in one fail swoop. On the calendar, if you're using that in the detail view, a force touch will allow you to switch between the list view, which is kind of the default view, or the day view. It will also allow you to jump back to today if you've navigated away from the current day. So force touch in the calendar. On the weather app, you can force touch on it to get different kinds of information on that outer ring. So on the outer ring, I think by default, you see the current condition by hour kind of around the watch face. You can change that to percent chance of rain or the temperature. By issuing a force touch, you'll see the different options. With that one, I don't find that as useful because you can also do the same thing by simply tapping the center of the weather app, the center area, and it will toggle between the different views. One that took me a while to find but is very useful is in Maps. Doing a force touch will give you the search options. It will also give you the ability to go into your contacts and pick a specific person from your contact. So if you need to find an address, you can pull it up there and to get at that force touch in the Maps. And then one other thing in digital touch, this isn't a force touch, but just an interesting thing. And another kind of gesture that is worth trying on the watch if you're looking for additional functionality is a long press or just kind of a, you know, press and hold on an area. And if you do that with the color picker in digital touch or in the sort of the color palette, you know, you've got all those little circles. If you press and hold on one of those circles, it'll bring up a custom color picker. And you can change that color, and it will remember that color. So you can change your color palette that you have available. And then a few other kind of cool little interface tips. If you've ever gone into the friend screen in digital touch, so pressing on the side button, if someone has sent you a digital touch and you missed their message, they may have a little blue dot by their icon just on the inside. And if they have a little blue dot, that means they sent you a digital touch, but you haven't viewed it yet. And so you can select that person and then just tap the digital touch icon at the bottom, and then it will automatically go in and play those missed digital touches. A lot of people kind of know the little trick because it was demoed. I think when Kevin, and I'm going to blank on his name, guy, the guy, Kevin Lynch, the guy from Adobe, was demoing the Apple Watch. Many people noticed that he would quickly turn the screen off simply by putting his hand over the top of the screen. So that's a cool little trick. If the screen's been on and you're done with it and you want to immediately dismiss it, just put your hand right over top of the display. And I found that using a flat palm works best. I tried doing kind of a cup method at first, and very often that would accidentally sort of trigger a button or, you know, click on something. So it kind of needs to be all at once, a flat palm on the surface of the screen, and that immediately shuts it off. You can also, I guess, silence if you've got audible alarms or something like that, you can silence it the same way by putting your hand over the top of the screen. Inevitably, you might end up with an application that gets stuck. I have to admit, my Apple Watch, it's a little bit buggy from time to time. Most frequently, I've noticed sort of Siri getting stuck open. You can actually force quit an application by holding down the side button until you see the power off screen, and then just hold the side button again or tap the side button again to return to the main screen, and that should quit out of and shut down that application, and then you could try relaunching it. Another cool little trick in the maps is that you can set a pin to mark your current location. This can be helpful if you've gone somewhere, maybe you parked your car and you want to remember where the car is parked, something like that. Open up the Maps application, tap on your location, you know, make sure you're on the blue dot, that it's found your location, and then you can tap on the blue dot and you'll see a couple different options, one of them being mark my location. And if you tap mark my location, it will drop a pin right in your current location. And then you can go about your business, and when you need to get back, you can find that purple pin, tap on it, and then you get the options for directions to find your way back. Interestingly, remember how I said if you try a long press, just sort of tap on the screen and hold that for a couple seconds? In a few apps, you might find some additional functionality. In the Maps app, anytime you want to drop a pin, if you just long press on that area, the pin will fly in and drop down in that location. So that can be helpful if you just want to know a distance from, say, where you are to a specific location. You can find that out and go in and get directions to that point. And then the last little Apple Watch tip that I have for you is customizing the stock message replies. So you know how if you receive a message on the Apple Watch and you choose the reply option, it kind of gives you some canned responses. I think it also tries to infer based on the context of the message, maybe some additional responses. But those few canned responses, they may or may not be phrases that you would normally say. You know, they like say, okay, or I'll be there soon, those sorts of things. If you want to personalize those a little bit, you can actually do that from the Apple Watch app. So on your iPhone, go into the Apple Watch app, go into Messages, and then there's a section called Default Replies. If you tap on that, you'll see that you can change and tailor those messages to be a little bit more personal, or you can even completely override them. So if you have phrases that you find that you're quickly typing back over and over again, you might want to plug in some of those common things that you have to text back, and that way you'll have those as options when you receive a message on your Apple Watch, and that could save you a lot of time and the need to go into the dictation, which I have to say the dictation is really, really good, though. It's worked very well for me. Another thing you might notice is that it will sort of do a two-step parsing of your dictation. It'll do a quick pass, which is usually, you know, kind of hit or miss. But if you just wait a second, it will also then take a second pass. I'm thinking that it's going in and looking at some of the context and the phrasing and how you're putting your words together to try and figure out any mistakes it might have made. And it will make the message a little bit more accurate. And that typically happens even before you hit send. So even if you accidentally quickly hit send, I think it takes that extra moment to kind of parse through that message and maybe change some things. So really finding that Siri seems to be, or dictation rather, seems to be a little bit more accurate on my Apple Watch, maybe even more so than on my iPhone. But I'd be curious to get to know your experience. Also, if you've come across any cool little Apple Watch tips or tricks for us, please shoot them to us. Send us an audio comment or an email, maccast@gmail.com. Something I know that we've talked about in the past here on the MacCast is backing or moving your iTunes library to an external drive. If you're like me or a lot of people, you have an ever-growing iTunes media library, especially if you started to buy a lot of purchase content from the iTunes store. You know, HD movies take up a lot of storage, and you want to back those things up. I know that Apple, you know, allows you to re-download them, but we've talked about the dangers of that. Sometimes Apple loses access to content, certain contracts don't get reapplied, so you're not always guaranteed to have those movies up there in the cloud. So you definitely want to at least download them once, make a backup copy or an archive so you have a copy of that. I personally just like to know that at least on one of my Macs, my main Mac, I have my entire library stored locally. So because of that, you know, I have a MacBook Pro. It only has a 500 gigabyte hard drive. I needed to move my library off to an external. And we've covered how to do that on past MacCasts. If you need to go back, search the website, I'm sure you can find that, or just email me. I'll help point you at the right episode. But something that we really haven't discussed, and a question that came up this week, is how do you back that stuff up? For example, my iTunes library on my external drive, I use a 2 terabyte, 2.5 inch USB drive for that library. My just media folder is over 1 terabyte in size. And David is also considering moving his entire library off to an external to free up space on his main drive, but asked the natural question, what about backup? You know, will or can Time Machine continue to back up my iTunes media folder? Because when it's in that default location in your home folder in the music folder, it gets backed up by Time Machine. And David, the short answer is when you move it to an external, no, Time Machine is by default not going to back that up. Time Machine only backs up your main hard drive. It does not back up those extra external drives by default. Now, there may be some tricks and things that you can do to get that to happen, but generally they're going to be more trouble than they are worth. And so I really wouldn't advise doing that. So my strategy that I'll share with you, and I'm not saying this is the best strategy, but this is sort of how I have handled it, is to use an application called ChronoSync from Econ Technologies. And this you can use for all sorts of things, including just general backups. You can use it for syncing folders. I know a lot of people who use it for syncing their home folder between, say, a desktop and a laptop. It's really great for that, although I've never used it for that functionality. I use it to sync the iTunes media folder on my external drive over to my Drobo. And what's cool about this is one of the features of ChronoSync is that you can set it up so that it does not synchronize deletions of files. So I have it set up in that way. So what happens is that nightly, ChronoSync is scheduled to run, and it will take a copy of everything that's in my iTunes media folder on my external drive and copy that over to a folder that I have set up on my Drobo. And if I ever delete anything out of my iTunes library, those will not get deleted on the Drobo backup. So what that means is things like applications, which get upgrades, so my iOS applications, I still have the upgrades, but I also have every version going back because those are never removed from the Drobo version of the ChronoSync archive. And that's saved me a few times when I've, you know, downloaded an update to an app and maybe it was faulty, had a bug in it or something like that, or just maybe Apple removed something from the iTunes store. So even if you have different versions of books, those sorts of things, you can kind of maintain that history. So that's one backup. And as you know, I'm a fanatic about backup. So my philosophy is if you don't have it in three places, it's not backed up. So I have it, you know, in my internal hard or on my external hard drive in the iTunes media folder. I now have a copy on my Drobo, and technically the Drobo has data redundancy, so really it's almost like having it in two places on the Drobo, but I still consider that's only one device, that's only one place. I also want a copy of my iTunes media folder offsite, so I also have it set up as part of my Crash Plan backup, because Crash Plan allows you to back up files and folders and volumes that are on externals. So I have it as part of my Crash Plan backup. So that's the way I handle that, David. You could also just get a second external hard drive, the same size as the one that you're using for your iTunes media, and then use an application like ChronoSync or a cloning application like SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner, and then just use that to make an exact copy of the drive that has your iTunes media library. So that would be one way to go. One advantage of maybe doing a similar thing like that with ChronoSync, which would be similar to what I do just using my Drobo, would be that you could maybe get one large external hard drive and then copy, you know, libraries or multiple things onto the same drive. And maybe that's a little more cost effective for you rather than just sort of having a clone of your iTunes media drive. So however you do it, the point is if you do move your iTunes library, your media files off to an external, you are going to need to set up some sort of backup plan for that data that doesn't include Time Machine, because Time Machine won't be able to back that up easily by default. So this next thing has been a little bit of a head scratcher for me. I didn't know exactly what was going on. But I started to notice after upgrading to OS X Yosemite on all of my Macs that I was having this weird thing where a number of my devices would lose their network name or have their network name changed. And I've seen this in the past with other versions of the operating system. Happens occasionally if you're having network issues, but it's really rare. Here it seemed to be happening on a number of the devices, a number of devices and machines on my network. And what you see is you'll see the network name of a device, and suddenly in parentheses it'll have a little number after the network name. So, you know, it might be Adams Macintosh, and then suddenly it's Adams Macintosh 1 or Adams Macintosh 2 or Adams Macintosh 3, or specifically in my case, my Apple TV was suddenly saying it was Apple TV parentheses 3, and my MacBook Air was MacBook Air parentheses 2. And those aren't the actual names, just, you know, I'm just doing those for clarity. But I noticed that, and I also noticed that occasionally I'd have weird slow network performance and computer issues, specifically things in Skype. And when I'd look into my activity monitor, what I'd see is this service called Discovery D, and it would be pegged at over 100% CPU usage. So it was like it was going haywire. And I didn't connect these two things together until I read a piece on Craig Hockenberry's The Chalks blog. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Fair warning, though, he gets into a lot of foul language, so it's definitely not safe for work. But up until I read his piece, I had simply just been doing resets and reboots to kind of get everything back in order, but inevitably it would slip back into these problems. And so what Craig discovered is that network processes were using 100% of the CPU, which is what I was experiencing. Wi-Fi was disconnecting at random times, and then suddenly you'd have these computer names or network names going out of whack. And the source of all this stuff did seem to be this process called Discovery D. And what Discovery D is it's the thing that replaced what used to be called MDNS Responder in OS X Mavericks and earlier. MDNS Responder was sort of the service that managed a lot of the networking functions that were at the core of OS X, things like resolving domain names, and I think also handling network names and things like that. And it served Mac OS X well for years and years and years, but with OS X Yosemite, Apple decided to replace it with this new service called Discovery D. And the main reasoning, I think, and the speculation is likely it was to add support for the functions like handoff and continuity that we got in OS X Yosemite. So that seamless way to kind of move stuff between your iPhone and your iPads and your desktop and vice versa. And so those are great features and we really like them. But the trouble is that we now have a new core piece of software, and like a lot of new software or rewritten software, it seems to have some pretty significant and serious bugs. You know, since OS X Yosemite's come out, networking, especially Wi-Fi networking, has just been incredibly buggy. So Apple needs to hunker down and really work on, I think, the Discovery D service. But if you've been suffering from these issues, this is likely the bane of your existence. And there's a few things that you can do to kind of help yourself out. So if suddenly Safari or your browser stops working and you can't seem to load local websites, you might have been hit by this. If you're suddenly seeing the duplicate name issue with the N's at the end of names, you might have been hit by this. Infrequently or inconsistently, you might have wake on demand issues. My wife's Mac Mini actually seems to be suffering from this right now. You'll just be walking by it and all of a sudden it'll be asleep and then it'll just come on. And I thought it was maybe the vibration moving the mouse, except she doesn't have a mouse. She has a Magic Trackpad. So I thought, well, maybe it's vibrating the keyboard. I don't really know. But now that I know it's the Discovery D service, which is part of Handoff, I'm thinking that maybe Handoff is detecting my phone nearby or me getting near the machine or within network range and actually causing it to sort of wake on demand. And another thing you might experience is you can't suddenly access your Mac from outside. So if you're using Back to My Mac or screen sharing, your remote access gets flaky, or maybe you're having Bonjour issues. All of these things under OS X Yosemite are probably related to some bugs in Discovery D. And One thing you can do if you think you're having trouble is, again, open up the Activity Monitor. So go into Applications, Utilities, Activity Monitor, and just look at the CPU usage and see if Discovery D isn't sort of running wild, running amok, using up all your processes and CPU cycles. And if it is, you can go ahead and kill it. I think it will sort of restart itself back up, and hopefully it'll be behaving better. But most of the fixes typically involve rebooting your Mac, also rebooting the devices that are having issues, and I mean completely shutting them down, possibly rebooting your router, and then bringing everything back up, and then it should all kind of get back in sync again. But that's a short-term fix. It can kind of go in and get all messed up again. You could also go in manually and just reset the machine name if you're just having that issue, so where you're getting, you know, My Macintosh 27 or whatever, you could go in and just change the machine name back. The place you do that is you go into System Preferences on the Mac, and then you go into the Sharing Preferences, and assuming the network doesn't still have the name that you want in the cache somewhere, because it the theory is it's somewhat probably a cache corruption of the DNS information. Assuming that's worked its way out, you should be able to change it back and it shouldn't give you any issues. If you get an error or you get some sort of message saying you can't change it because that device is already on your network, you're probably going to have to do the reboot shutdown thing and start all over. One other thing that I think has helped me out a little bit when I started to have this issue is I went through my airport and I assigned DHCP reservations to every single device on my network. And for those of you who don't know what this is, you know, when you connect a device to your Mac network, it's going to get an IP address from your router. So in most cases, that's going to be something like your airport, or if you're using a Linksys, it doesn't really matter what the device is. And it gets a random IP address from a pool of available IP addresses that are set in a range, you know, for your local area network. So I have a range, and what I did is with a DHCP reservation, what you could do is you can tell it, hey, if you see this specific machine, always give it this address. So it'll always kind of get the same, it'll reserve specific IPs for specific machines. So it's not like manually assigning the IP, but in a way it's making sure that, you know, you're never going to have conflicts. It's always going to issue that same number to that machine. And I did this for everything, including my Internet of Things devices. So things like my Nest thermostat and my Nest Protect smoke detectors and my Insteon lights and my printers. All of those devices, I set up DHCP reservations. And the way you do this, if you have an airport, I don't know how you do it if you have another router, but with an airport, you go into Airport Utility, you go to the Network tab, and you'll see a DHCP Reservations tab. And then there's a list, and you can add them by clicking the little plus. You can also remove ones that are already there by selecting them and hitting the minus. But you hit the plus, and then what you have to do is you have to give it an identifier for the machine. And so you can either use the MAC address for the machine, or what's called the DHCP client ID. And then you tell it the IP address within the range that your router's going to use. So I use the 10.0 range. You might use 192.168. And if you don't know what this stuff is, then you probably don't need to worry about DHCP reservations. Or you can just do some Googling online and get information about local, you know, private IP ranges and how that works with your routers and stuff like that. I'm getting a little bit technical here into, you know, some of the networking stuff, but this is pretty high level. Anyway, you're going to want to make sure you put in an IP address that's in the range that you have set up for your router, and then you should be good to go. The next time you connect that device or that machine to your network, it should get the IP that you told the airport to give it. And if you prefer to use the DHCP client ID as the identifier for your machine, you assign those manually. I think they're a little bit easier to manage because you can give each machine a name that makes sense. The way you assign those is from the System Preferences on your Mac. You go into Network, and then you click on Advanced, and then in the TCP IP tab, you'll see the DHCP client ID. And you can put a label in there. So you might say, I think, you know, I have like Adams-MacBook-Pro-Wi-Fi. And that's the Wi-Fi IP address for my MacBook Pro. You can set up whatever name you want. I don't think you can have spaces or anything like that. Thus, I use the dashes. But do it however you like and however you remember those. And that's what you'll use when you go into your airport to set up the DHCP reservations. But that seems to have helped out a little bit with some of my network issues. I did it just a couple days ago, and I haven't seen the Discovery D issues return, so I don't know if it's permanently fixed, but it might be worth a try, and it might help you out. So that's what's going on if you run into that issue, and let's just hope that Apple issues a fix for it or gets on top of it and fixes it up pretty quickly. Now, kind of along the same line, since Discovery D, you know, one of the reasons we have it is for the whole FaceTime continuity handoff thing. You know, one of those features that's related to that is the ability to kind of answer a phone call. So if you're getting a phone call, to pick that phone call up on your Mac. And timing, how about that? I got a phone call. I don't know if you heard that. I got a phone call actually right as that was I was saying that spot. That's so weird. Anyway, yeah, if one of those things comes in, right, you have the ability to answer it on your Mac. Well, Kenny had a question for us related to that functionality.
Hi, Adam. It's Kenny calling from O'Fallon, Illinois. Very big fan of the podcast and appreciate what you do. I had a question about making phone calls from my Mac. Since I got Yosemite and iOS 8, I really enjoy the capability of answering and making phone calls from my Mac that are coming in through my phone. My problem has to do with sound input and output. Day-to-day, sound from my Mac comes out of speakers, and the input is my camera mounted on top of the monitor. But this doesn't work well for phone calls. I have to be very close to the microphone to make it people hear me clearly. What I'd like is when a phone call comes in for a way to manage sound through the FaceTime calls so that I can have a USB headset hooked up. And when I make a phone call, the sound automatically gets routed through the headset, and the rest of the sounds will stay through the computer speakers and microphone. So I was wondering if you know of any utilities to help me do that, or any settings in the Mac that take care of sounds just for those phone calls. I appreciate it. Look forward to hearing back. Thanks.
Hey, Kenny. Unfortunately, the answer is going to be no. I'm not aware of any default settings or any way to set that separately from the system input. I'm also not aware of any third-party applications or tools or utilities that will allow you to do that just for FaceTime, which is FaceTime is essentially what is handling those calls on your Mac. So they kind of get handed off to the FaceTime application. So I went in there and I poked around the settings. I did not see anything obvious. I asked a few people who I trust, and no one seemed to know a way to actually do that. But that doesn't mean I'm going to leave you high and dry. I'm going to give you the tip that I use. The best thing that I know you can do is at least set up a way to quickly change those inputs and outputs. And you can do that using a little trick with the sound options in the menu bar. So the first thing to do would be make sure that you have the volume controls in your menu bar. Just go into System Preferences under Sound and make sure you've got checked on the Show Volume in Menu Bar option. And then what happens is when that call comes in, you can either take the call or what have you. I usually take the call first, and then if I need to switch the sound inputs, what I can do is while I'm talking to the person, and it'll happen pretty much seamlessly, I can option click on the volume icon, and that will show you the input and output options for anything that you have connected to your Mac. So that'll include Bluetooth input or output sources. And you can quickly just select those and then take your call. And then when you're done, you can use the same technique if you'd like to switch them back. So say if you were listening to music on a set of external speakers, or you just wanted to change back to a set of headphones, something like that, you can switch them. And that's about the quickest way that I can think to do it. Maybe there's a way to write some sort of creative Apple script that gets triggered. I don't know. There might be some workarounds, and hopefully our community can chime in on that. But as far as I know, that's how I would handle it, at least at this point. And then hope, and maybe even give some feedback to Apple at apple.com/feedback, ask that they add some sort of way to kind of set a default for FaceTime for the input-output settings. I think that would actually make sense. I mean, Skype kind of handles it that way, so that would be a great way to do it. So I may even go over and give Apple that feedback, but thanks for your question and thanks for your email. And then let's finish up the day with my thing of the moment. Actually, today it's something I briefly mentioned on a recent MacCast, not directly related to the thing of the moment. I think we were talking about the new MacBook and the fact that it's getting so thin that in some cases MacBooks... Oh, no, we were talking about the screen, the Retina screen or anti-glare coating coming off on some Macs. And I was talking about even these days with the laptops getting thinner, your screen can start to kind of push into your keys. And I've always worried in those cases about possible damage or things like that. I'm also very fanatical, as a lot of us are, just about the condition and keeping my Macs in pristine condition in terms of the case not getting scratched up, especially on the outside and things like that. And I even made my thing of the moment, my pick on Mac Break Weekly. And what it is it's the RadTech screensavers and Rad sleeves. This is something I've been using on my Macs for years, and I would never buy a new Mac without buying a set of these. So they're kind of two different products. The screensavers is a little microfiber. It's this awesome stuff called OptiTech, I think is what it's called. And it's just this really soft, nice microfiber sheet that you can lay over your keyboard, between your keyboard and your screen, and it keeps things like just typing on your keys, the natural oils from your fingers are going to come off on there. And now that laptops are so thin, when you close the lid, especially if you're going to throw your laptop into a bag and it might get a little pressure on it, the screen can just sort of gently kind of get pushed down onto the keys. And those dirts and oils and stuff like that will transfer, and then you get dust on there. And if you've ever seen someone open up their laptop and they kind of have the key imprint on their screen, that's what happens. And this nice little microfiber cloth will protect your Mac from that. I know people that will save, you know, Apple gives a little foam sheet sometimes that comes with your laptop. Sometimes people will save and reuse that. This is much nicer, the screensaver. And you can put that down there. It looks really, really great. They come in a whole range of colors. So originally I had gray. My new ones are this great deep wine purple. They have black, green, blue, and red. And so that's the one for kind of protecting your keys and your screen and stuff like that. Then they also have the Rad sleeves, which is like a little microfiber pouch. It's the same material, but you slide your notebook into that, and then that just protects the outside of it. And I like that because I can slide it into my laptop bag, and I don't have to worry about what might be around my notebook. As a matter of fact, I like to slide my iPad right in the same compartment right next to it, and I know that the iPad's not going to get scratched, my Mac's not going to get scratched, because I've got this nice microfiber cloth. And then the additional benefit is it can double as a cleaning cloth. So I often use the little screensaver, fold it up, and use it to wipe down my display and keep all the fingerprints off and keep it nice and pristine. And they're super rugged, super durable. I had my one for my 15-inch MacBook Pro for, I know, since I got it. So like 2008, 2009, because Apple didn't really change the size of the notebook for a number of years, at least not significantly. So I was able to use mine up until recently, and it was only getting a little bit rough around the edges, and I just decided I kind of wanted a refreshed new one. So I ordered up a new set. They're really, really great. They're from RadTech. RadTech.us is the website. And great news is they reached out to me on Twitter, and right now they've offered to give all MacCast listeners a 20% discount on most of their products. So if you use the code MacCast20, MacCast20 at checkout, you're going to get 20% off. And so you could get your own set. Plus, they also offered to give us some products, or give me some products to give away to you. So I've got a bunch of stuff from RadTech to give away. I've got a couple of Urban Armor cases for iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus, some AC power and auto power adapters. I've got 3 different screensavers in different colors for 15-inch MacBook Pros, a couple of WaveJammer Bluetooth wireless audio receivers. And so we're going to give this stuff away. If you'd like to be entered to get it, all you have to do is go to maccast.com/radtech. That's RADTECH. maccast.com/radtech. And there's a little form there. Just fill it out. And I do ask if you have an iPhone 6, 6 Plus or a 15-inch MacBook Pro, because I want to make sure whoever gets those prizes, you know, it can potentially go to someone who can use them. I'm not going to do that exclusively. We're just going to do a random drawing. So, you know, I'm not going to use that as, oh, you're not going to get it because I pulled your name and you don't have an iPhone 6. We'll still send you the case if you want it. But it's just so that I can give preference to those folks who might have one of those devices. It makes a little bit more sense, I think. So go there to enter. Also, use your discount code to get a discount and check out the screensavers and Rad Sleeves. Again, I swear by them. I've been using them for years. And I just want to say thanks to RadTech for, you know, giving us a couple to give away here on the show. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. If you want to get a little cash to buy that Apple Watch, you know, get rid of one of your old iPhones you got lying around. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com and lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, learn and pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free 10-day trial by going to lynda.com/maccast. That's lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. I'd also like to thank CashFly for providing the bandwidth for the MacCast. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They're at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, a tip for Apple Watch, something you want to send me, you can send your audio comments, your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call our listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's a great community of folks who hang out, try and help each other with questions, Mac tech things, just general. If you want to gab about Macs and you don't have someone to do that with in your own life, check out the forum. It's a great place to do that, and it's totally free to sign up and participate. If you want to find me on social media, I'm on the Twitters, twitter.com/maccast, or on the Facebooky thing over at facebook.com/themaccast. And if you prefer the googly type stuff, you can find me on Google Plus. There's a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast and you'll find us hanging out there. But plenty of opportunities to interact, and please do. I love hearing from you. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.